Last time, we began to study Genesis chapter 38, which is the story about the fourth son of Jacob, whose name is alternately called Israel, and that fourth son is Judah. It is from the tribe of Judah that we have the Jews. So let's reread chapter 38 so that we can begin afresh. Genesis chapter 38. Genesis chapter 38. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 42. Genesis chapter 38. We're going to read it all. Very interesting story here. It was at this time that Judah went off from his brothers and settled near a man named Hirah, who was an Adullami. There Judah saw one of the daughters of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shuah, and he took her and slept with her, and she conceived and had a son whom he named Er. She conceived again and had a son and called him Onan. Then she conceived yet again and had a son whom she called Shelah. He was in Kziv when she gave birth to him. Now Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was evil from Adonai's perspective, so Adonai killed him. Judah said to Onan, "Go and sleep with your brother's wife. Perform the duty of a husband's brother to her and preserve your brother's line of descent." However, Onan knew that the child wouldn't count as his. So whenever he had intercourse with his brother's wife, he spilled the semen on the ground so as not to give his brother offspring. What he did was evil from Adonai's perspective, so he killed him too. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Stay a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I don't want him to die too, like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived at home with her father, and in due time Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And after Judah had been comforted, he went up to be with his sheep shearers in Timnah, he and his friend Hirah the Adullami. Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law has gone up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's clothes, completely covered her face with a veil, and she sat at the entrance to Ainaim, which is on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, but she still was not being given to him as a wife, as his wife. And when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute because she covered her face. So he went over to her where she was sitting and said, not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, "Come, let me sleep with you." And she answered, "What will you pay to sleep with me?" He said, "I'll give you a kid from the flock of goats." She said, "Will you also give me something as a guarantee until you send it?" He answered, "What should I give you as a guarantee?" And she said, "Your seal with its cord and the staff you're carrying in your hand." So he gave them to her. They then went and slept with her, and she conceived by him. She got up and went away, took off her veil, and put on her widow's clothes. Now Judah sent the kid with his friend, the Adullami, to receive the guarantee items back from the woman, but he couldn't find her. And he asked the people near where she'd been, "Where's the prostitute who's on the road to Ainaim?" But they answered, "There hasn't been any prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I couldn't find her, and also the people said there hasn't been any prostitute here." Judah said, "All right, let her keep the things so that we won't be publicly shamed. I sent the kid, but you couldn't find her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been acting like a whore. Moreover, she's pregnant as a result of her prostitution." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned alive." And when she was brought out, she sent this message to her father-in-law, "I am pregnant by the man to whom these things belong. Determine, I beg you, who these are, the signet, the cords, and the staff." Then Judah acknowledged owning them. He said, "She's more righteous than I, because I didn't let her become the wife of my son Shelah." And he never slept with her again. And when she went into labor, it became evident that she was going to have twins. And as she was in labor, one of them put out his hand, and the midwife took his hand and tied a scarlet thread on it, saying, "This one came out first." But then he withdrew his hand and his brother came out. So she said, "How did you manage to break out first?" Therefore, he was named Peretz, breaking out. Then out came his brother with the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was given the name Zerach, scarlet. What we have here is a story of bloodlines and genealogy. But it's also a story that relates cultural information from that era, as well as historical data that we're going to find linked in later times to cities and places and people. Almost all the names of places that we find here, Adullam, Chezib, Timnah, Enam, or Enayim, all these places, they're going to appear later in the Bible as being located within the tribal territory of Judah. So while this section of Israelite history seems a little bit disconnected from the direction the Torah seems to be taking, making Joseph's life the central theme through the remainder of Genesis, in fact, it's here to show Judah's rise to prominence and then make some connections even in the life of the future King David. Now, I want to remind you that at the time of this story, Israel is still several centuries away from possessing the land of Canaan and from dividing Canaan up into 12 districts, one for each of the 12 tribes. The time frame of this story is somewhere between the day that Joseph was sold off to those slave traders and the day that Jacob decided to move his entire family to Egypt to survive the famine. Now, what we see in this narrative is that Judah had children with a Canaanite woman, a most definite no-no to God. We aren't told the name of this woman, only that her father's name was Shua. Now, without doubt, we will see that Judah had made a conscious decision to part ways with his family, the rest of the Israelites, for a time. And this is reflected in the first words of this chapter when it says, Judah left his brothers. He knew full well that marriage to a Canaanite woman was not to be contemplated among the Israelites. And as we all know, when we want to do something that is both wrong and unacceptable to our families, what do? We separate ourselves from them so that we don't have to face them. That's what Judah did. Now, this unnamed woman produces three sons for Judah, but none of these should have been suitable. None of these sons should have been suitable to carry on the line of the covenant promise, because they were all of Canaanite blood. But without doubt, this never even occurred to Judah. Nor apparently did it matter to him that his uncle Esau had been passed over for the firstborn blessing, partially because he had married a Canaanite woman. And here was Judah doing the same thing. I mean, how often we tend to do what Judah did. We claim faith in God, and then we separate that faith from the everyday matters of our lives. And what troubles and sorrows that mindset and behavior inevitably brings to us, just as it was about to bring to Judah. Yet, as was going to happen on a regular basis, foreign women were brought into Israel. They were assimilated, and in time, they were considered Israelites. Now, this principle of being adopted into Israel or grafted into Israel or whatever term you might like to use was one of the earliest principles that was set down by Yahweh. At the end of this chapter, we'll talk a little bit more about this matter of Canaanite women and Israel. Now, as the three sons of Judah matured, the firstborn son of Judah, Er, was given a wife selected, as was customary, by Judah. This wife's name was Tamar. Now, Tamar just means palm tree. But we are told that God killed Er because he was evil. So Tamar was now a widow. What is key here is that Tamar was a childless widow. Childless. Or more correctly, a sonless widow. She may well have produced some girl babies before her husband's death. We don't know. Onan, who is now the second son of Judah, was then instructed to go and take his brother's widow, Tamar, as his wife. This was simply a custom of that day. And generally speaking, it was not optional. It was the law that the brother do this. The idea was that just as a female could be a substitute wife, a concubine, a baby producer, just like we saw with Hagar and we saw with Bilhah and we saw with Zilpah, for a woman who, this was done for a woman who was unable to bear children for her husband, so could a substitute husband impregnate a woman whose husband had died and left her without a son. This tradition was based on the substitute husband usually being a family member, normally a brother of that deceased man. The traditional name for this law among the Hebrews is levirate marriage. Levirate marriage. Now, it might appear from its name that this is taken from the Hebrew tribal name of Levi. It's not. The actual Hebrew word for this ordinance is not levirate, it's yibum. Yibum. All right? Our modern translation of levirate is actually taken from the Latin word lever, lever, which is the designation for a husband's brother. So Levi and levirate are just spelled, similarly spelled words in English that are pronounced similarly, but they're in no way related. Now, the levirate marriage was not at all unique to Israel. It existed in all other cultures as well. This is well attested to with the well-preserved Hittite documents, even documents from the Middle Assyrian age. This levirate law can be found eventually in Deuteronomy 25. We read this. Now, remember, where we are now, way before the law. But eventually, this became law. In Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 5, when brothers live together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as a wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He's not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak with him. And if he persists and still says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off of his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, this is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house, and in Israel his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal has been removed. I don't think I can live with that. This sandal flinging is a rebuff. It indicates the poor character of someone who refuses to do his family duty. It's public humiliation. It may not sound like much to us. It was a big deal to them. But in verse 9, we're told that Onan, the brother of the deceased heir, refused to have children with Tamar, and then God killed him because he, too, was evil in God's eyes. Why did Onan refuse to do this? It didn't seem like a big deal. Well, it says he did it because the son produced wouldn't have been his. Now, let me dissect that a little bit. The brother who died, heir, was the firstborn. Onan was the secondborn, but as the eldest surviving brother, he now held firstborn status. But if he produced a child in the name of his deceased brother, the firstborn, that child would have been entitled to part of Judah's estate. In other words, Onan would have received less if his deceased elder brother's family line had continued on. Now, it's not that it was uncommon for family maneuvering to gain the most power and the most wealth when the father died, But to intentionally deny this widow a son did two things. First, it meant that her deceased husband's family line would end. This was a disaster to the ancient mind. And second, she'd have no son to care for her as she grew older. This was tantamount to living out her days in extreme poverty. So for Onan to knowingly do this made him selfish and callous to a very high degree. And Yehovah took his life as a consequence of it. Now, by custom, then, it would have been the levirate duty of Judah's third son, Shelah, to marry the twice widowed Tamar. But it was judged that she was too young, he was too young to marry. So Judah sent Tamar to go home and to live with her own father until Shelah grew up and was old enough to marry her. But as the words, "for he thought," this is referring to Judah, indicate, Judah had absolutely no intention of allowing his last living son to marry Tamar. Time passed. Judah's wife, the mother of his three sons, dies. The third son, Shelah, matured and apparently was now old enough to marry, but Judah wouldn't allow it. He had seen the result of his other two sons marrying Tamar. They died. I think it's safe to say that Judah didn't know why they died, but we are told it was because they were evil, but I see no indication that Judah knew this. We have to understand that Judah was currently living a life utterly oblivious to God and his laws and his commandments. To Judah, Tamar was really bad luck. And he wasn't going to chance losing his last son, his last heir, by letting him marry this woman who seemed to bring down God's wrath upon all of her husbands. Well, after the formal period of mourning of his wife, probably 30 days, Judah goes to find a place called Timnah to supervise and participate in the sheep shearing season. Tamar found out about this. So she took off her widow's garb, and we know from other biblical accounts that women were required to wear special clothing when their husbands died as an indication of their time of mourning. Typically, it was only during this 30-day period that they wore the widow's garb, but possibly because Tamar had been denied her right to have a child from her deceased husband's brother, she continued longer to live in a state of mourning. Well, Judah was doing a terrible thing, a shameful thing, by not allowing his youngest son, Shelah, to marry Tamar. And Tamar was greatly disgraced by this. So she developed a plan. She would find a way to sleep with her father-in-law, Judah, and directly from his seed perform the all-important task of carrying on the bloodlines of her dead husband's family. Now, understanding that Judah would never knowingly do this, Tamar disguises herself as a prostitute. She has a veil placed over her face, and she sets herself at a place called Einaim. Now, this must have been a very well-known spot for prostitutes to find clients, for Einaim means eyes that look. In other words, it's a place where men looked for just this kind of woman. But even more, notice that she was thought to be, and it says it, a temple prostitute. That is, the Canaanites, you see, had adopted prostitution as a worship practice. It was symbolizing fertility. And it was connected with the pagan temple to Baal. This was a duty. In many ways, it was seen as an honor for these women to be prostitutes for Baal, and it was considered a legitimate practice by both customer and client. So Judah, so far off the reservation in his current state of mind, he didn't think anything about it. Most of the mystery Babylon-based religions adopted sacred sex as part of their religious practices. And there is a movement, by the way, within the fringe of the new spiritualist and New Age movements around the world, including in this nation, to bring this practice back. Their stated goal is to combine the erotic with the sacred, another fundamental of Mystery Babylon religions. Now, this is just a case in point of how easily we can adopt traditions within the church that aren't really in line with God's word or will, usually taken from something out of the pagan world's customs, and then make them as though they're a good thing. And while we can attach sincerity to some of these long-held and comfortable traditions, often as with Judah here, these things are an abomination to God. Well, Tamar's plan works. She tricks Judah into thinking she's just a temple prostitute. He purchases her favors. She becomes pregnant. About 3 months later, when it's clear to everybody that Tamar is with child, someone tells Judah about it. And in order to save the family honor, Judah orders her burned to death for what amounts to adultery. After all, she was unmarried and pregnant, and this was proof of her offense. Now, the notion in that era was that Tamar was bringing dishonor, was bringing shame to Judah and his household. Shame was an enormous social stigma that was to be avoided at all costs. The price of restoring one's honor often required the death of the one who caused the shame. However, Judah finds out that he is the father of Tamar's child and realizes that by withholding his last son, Shelah, from Tamar, he's caused her to take this drastic action. He now declares that it is he is the one who's done wrong, not Tamar, and he repents, and she is spared. Even more, Judah says that Tamar was righteous in what she did. Now, look, this is another one of many statements in the Bible that, while historically true and is accurate, the person making the statement is just plain wrong in what they're saying. Tamar wasn't righteous in what she did, even more than Judah was righteous in what he eventually did. God simply used them despite their sin and rebellion to achieve his divine purposes. However, we should probably think more in terms of Tamar's righteousness as being about her doing something that was culturally seen as righteous, as opposed to being seen by God as righteous. And by being culturally righteous, she didn't bring shame upon herself or her family. Well, Tamar goes on, we're told, to have twin boys, Peretz and Zerach. Now, to Judah, his wrong had been to cause shame upon Tamar by not giving her his son Shelah as a husband for her. That is the breaking of a tradition. But the wrong that was actually being righted was of a spiritual nature, because Judah intended to carry on his family line via his Canaanite wife, who had produced Canaanite children, and God was going to have none of it. Judah was utterly oblivious to his sin before God, because to him, everything turned out okay in the end. So, at least he thought it did. The ancient rabbis give us a very helpful piece of information that's not contained in this story. Tamar is a Semite. She's a descendant of Shem, the sanctified line of good. That is, she is not Canaanite. She is not a descendant of Ham, the accursed Canaanite line of evil. Up to now, Judah had produced his three sons by a Canaanite woman. And what happened to these three sons, pardon me, I don't know where that came from. And what happened to these three sons of a Canaanite mother? Well, two of them died. The third one that should have given Tamar a son by custom and would have produced the line that carried on the line of Judah never got the opportunity to do that, because Judah refused to let it happen for all the wrong reasons. The result is Judah himself unwittingly made Tamar pregnant. The result is, despite Judah's intention that the line of covenant promise, which he apparently didn't much care about, would have been polluted by Canaanite blood, it wound up that Judah impregnated a Semite woman, Tamar, and from her came the Semite sons that would carry on the line of promise. We have seen in previous chapters to what length God would go to not allow Canaanite blood to be mixed with Israelite blood, particularly when it would affect the line of covenant promise. Jehovah even did it when the covenant line was not directly affected, as when the planned marriage between Jacob's daughter Dinah, and the king of Shechem's son was averted when all the males of Shechem were killed by Simeon and Levi. But since Judah is the father of Tamar's children, and since Tamar is a Semite, the children from their union would be, from a bloodline standpoint, acceptable to God. So we see that the particular line of covenant promise that began with Abraham, which went on to Isaac, to Jacob, now to Judah, the purity of that line then would eventually produce the Messiah. It's preserved by Tamar rather's bold and unsavory act. And as we look in other chapters of the Bible, where we will see the lengthy genealogy of Jesus, we get confirmation of this, because we see that Peretz, the firstborn of Tamar's twin sons, is a direct ancestor of Yeshua. Peretz, son of Judah by his daughter-in-law, Tamar, his widowed daughter-in-law, is the one who carries forth the line of covenant promise for the tribe of Judah with no Canaanite blood in them. Further, we see God's governing dynamic of sanctification at work. Peretz is divided, separated, elected away from all the other children of Judah to be the conduit to continue on with the all-important line of covenant promise first given to Abraham. But we also see the governing dynamic of divine providence playing out as Judah and Tamar each attempt to satisfy some of their cultural traditions and their own selfish lusts and ambitions. Neither of them had the intent to obey God, nor did either of them realize they would produce the next generation of the line of covenant promise, Peretz. There could not be a better example and demonstration of divine providence than this story. So there's more significance to this chapter than meets the eye. But now let's move on to Genesis chapter 39. Because here the Torah resumes the tale of Joseph in chapter 39. His time in Canaan is over, and his life in Egypt begins when he's but a teenager. And it's not going to end there until his death. Let's read Genesis chapter 39, all of it. Open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 39. It's page 43 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Genesis chapter 39. Yosef was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelim, the Ishmaelites, Arabs, who had brought him there. Adonai was with Joseph, and he became wealthy while he was in the household of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw how Adonai was with him, that Adonai prospered everything he did. Joseph pleased him as he served him, and his master appointed him manager of his household. He entrusted all of his possessions to Joseph. From the time he appointed him manager of his household and all of his possessions, Adonai blessed the Egyptian's household for Joseph's sake. Adonai's blessing was on all he owned, whether in the house or in the field. So he left all of his possessions in Joseph's care, and because he had him, he paid no attention to his affairs except for the food he ate. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome as well. In time, the day came when his master's wife took a look at Joseph and said, "Sleep with me." But he refused, saying to his master's wife, "Look, because my master has me, he doesn't know what's going on in his house. He has put all of his possessions in my charge. In this house, I'm his equal. He hasn't withheld anything from me except yourself because you're his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" But she kept pressing him day after day. Nevertheless, he didn't listen to her. He refused to sleep with her or even be with her. However, one day, when he went into the house to do his work and none of the men living in the house was there indoors, she grabbed him by his robe and said, "Sleep with me." But he fled, leaving his robe in her hand, and got himself outside. But when she saw that he had left his robe in her hand and had escaped, she called the men of her house and said to them, "Look at this. My husband brought in a Hebrew just to make fools of us. He came in and wanted to sleep with me, but I yelled out loudly. And when he heard me yelling like that, he left his robe with me and he ran out." And she put the robe aside until his master came home. Then she said to him, "This Hebrew slave you brought us came in to make a fool out of me. But when I yelled out, he left his robe with me and fled outside. And when his master heard what his wife said, as she showed him, 'Here's what your slave did to me,' he became furious. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison in the place where the king's prisoners were kept. And there he was in the prison. But Adonai was with Joseph, showing him grace, giving him favor in the sight of the prison warden. The prison warden made Joseph supervisor of all the prisoners in the prison, so that whatever they did there, he was in charge of it. The prison warden paid no attention to anything Joseph did, because Adonai was with him, and whatever he did, Adonai prospered." This chapter begins with Joseph down in Egypt and Potiphar purchasing him as a house servant. Now, the first verse says something that seems so obvious to us that our eyes kind of skip right over it, or we don't pay it any heed, but it's this. Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard, an Egyptian. Here we are in Egypt, and we have to be told Potiphar is an Egyptian? What else would we have expected than for the second in command over all of Egypt, but that he would have been an Egyptian? Yet Moses, who wrote this down, made a point of it for some reason. The answer lies in the fact that at one time, long before Israel became a sovereign nation, Egypt was conquered, and it found itself under the control of non-Egyptians. The thing is, it was only in later times that Egypt sought a position as a world power. Up to Joseph's time, Egypt had been a very highly developed civilization that had contact with the outer world, had sent emissaries, and even developed trade with the outer world, but the goal seems to have only been to make Egypt, within its own borders, a great nation, a prosperous nation. Historically, up to the time of Joseph, there appears to have been no aggressive imperialistic designs by Egypt. However, as is the case since there have been nations, that goal turned out not to be a two-way street. They soon found out that simply being a peace-loving nation, trying to just get along with its neighbors, didn't immunize them from conflict or from aggression. Egypt was attacked and it was routed by Bedouins, Semites, who had come from the area of Arabia and Syria. The war was not a result of any dispute that we're aware of between Egypt and these Semites, but it was simply because these Bedouins wanted what Egypt had. And these Semite rulers controlled Egypt for around two centuries. That's right. Semites, sons of Shem, cousins of Israel, they sat as Pharaoh on the throne of Egypt, not Egyptians. The Egyptians called these foreign rulers of Egypt the Hyksos. Hyk means king, Sos means shepherd. So these foreigners were known as the shepherd kings. And we don't know a lot about them, nor are we able to precisely place them in time, because the records from the Hyksos period are very scant. This might seem strange in itself, because the Egyptians were tremendous writers of history. They were great records keepers. But on the other hand, as was typical of most ancient nations, the Egyptians did not record defeats. They didn't record times when they were subjugated. What we know of this time generally comes from records from private Egyptian citizens who lived through that terrible era for the Egyptians. But even with some inherent historical inconsistencies and contradictory scientific evidence, scholars generally agree that during the time of Joseph, and perhaps 100 years or so, maybe a little more, after Joseph's death, it was Semite shepherd kings that ruled over Egypt. So with Bedouins, Semites, in control at the time that Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt, it explains why Moses thought it important to mention that Potiphar was not a Bedouin. He was an Egyptian. He was an exception. And it also explains how, as we're going to soon discover, the Pharaoh seemed to have a little trouble with giving Joseph, a foreigner, a Hebrew, an Israelite, such an incredible amount of authority over Egyptians. For the best current evidence is, indeed, the Pharaoh was not an Egyptian. He and Joseph were Semites, kind of cousins. Now, with all that as a background, let's continue. Joseph is a very good-looking young man. And Potiphar's wife is quite taken with him. He also, in some way, which we're not told, became prosperous. So apparently he was able to do more than simply to serve Potiphar. All we know is that God was with Joseph, and he did well for himself, and he did well for Potiphar. Now we're going to find this statement that God was with Joseph four times in this chapter. And obviously it's to make the point that even though Joseph was abandoned by his family and he was placed into a strange land with strange gods, the God of Israel was still with him. He was protecting him, controlling matters, guiding events. Bad circumstances, listen to me, bad circumstances in your life, that doesn't mean God's turned his back on you. It's not what it means. Even the fact that the Semite Hyksos were in power, this was divine providence. Though, of course, Joseph was oblivious to all this. Well, Potiphar's wife was infatuated with Joseph, constantly after him. He refuses all of her advances, and it happens again and again and again. And one day, Mrs. Potiphar tires of being rebuffed by a purchased house servant. So she grabs Joseph, and he runs for his life. But in doing so, she grabs a piece of his garment. Then she decides to take revenge for being scorned. She claims Joseph tried to rape her, tells her husband this, Joseph is thrown into prison. Notice also that she declares in verse 14 that this Hebrew was brought in by her husband to make fools of her household. This is another indication of the hatred that the Egyptians had for any Semite. And this was due to their current condition of being subjugated by Semitic people, even though this particular group of Semites wasn't Hebrews. And within no time, Joseph is made supervisor over all the prisoners. And by the way, although the concept of prison is one that's always been part of our society, it was not part of every society in Joseph's day. Prisons didn't exist among most of the Canaanite societies, didn't exist among the Hebrews. God protected Joseph even though he was locked up. Interestingly, we're going to find in the next chapter that Joseph was not kept with the other prisoners. He was being kept in the home of the prison captain, although it was some kind of a dungeon or a basement and not the normal household living space. But just as important was that without his knowing it, Joseph was proving his trustworthiness to the very man who had locked him up and undoubtedly all who came into contact with him. This was about to serve him quite well, as God was about to do something astonishing. God's governing dynamic number two, divine providence, is a central theme to Joseph's life. We will begin chapter 40 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.